4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret. Veronica Rickard will be back with me tomorrow. Coming up, low gas prices might be a welcome sign at the pump, but an energy expert warns it could have unforeseen negative consequences in the future. First, new federal rules could change the way Wisconsin deals with potentially contaminated drinking water, especially when it comes to E. coli. At issue, when the state issues boil orders for potential contamination, which is a question right now in at least one Wisconsin community. Danielle Kading is following this issue. She's a reporter for WPR based in Superior. Danny, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
So we'll get into the details of these new drinking water rules in a moment. But first, you reported it on a community in Marengo, Wisconsin, a little south of Ashland, that's dealing with this potential E. coli issue. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so there was a sample of the drinking water that was taken from this mobile home park in Marengo. And the sample came up positive for a type of bacteria that's called total coliform bacteria. And when this bacteria is present, it generally indicates that there's a problem with the public water system, that there's some barriers that have broken down, or that it may be at risk for contamination.
So this is something, a sign that something bad could happen. In and of itself, it isn't necessarily going to give us E. coli contamination.
That's correct.
So under current rules, the way things are now, how is this issue being dealt with there in Marengo?
So under current rules, whenever they see a positive finding of this total coliform bacteria statewide, which they have about 300 each year out of 12,000 water systems, they typically issue a precautionary boil water notice just so that people are protecting themselves in the event that the system would become contaminated.
So this could go south. It could get bad. So boil your water until this gets fixed.
Essentially.
Well, now let's get into what's going to change now in the new federal rules. You talked to Steve Elmore, Public Water Supply Section Chief with the Bureau in Charge of Drinking Water and Groundwater for the state's DNR. Let's give a listen to the basics here.
One of the big changes there is the rule does not require a boil water order following a total coliform positive only. It only requires the boil water order when E. coli is found in the water system. The reason for that is the total coliform is an indicator organism, but it doesn't mean the water will make you sick. E. coli, we know, is a pathogen that will make you sick, and so it focused that sort of immediate response on those contaminants that we know make us sick.
So as I understood that, Danny, what would change is in a situation like there in Marengo, they've got that total coliform result, but not E. coli. So under the new rules, the DNR wouldn't say, they wouldn't issue this boil your water order.
Well, they wouldn't be required to, that's right. But that doesn't mean that they wouldn't issue a boil water notice when there is a public health risk. In the situation of Marengo, you know, Steve Elmore said that because there are some other things going on at that site, in particular with septic holding tanks there, they're seeing leaking from those tanks in some cases, overflowing into a ditch that goes close to the water supply. So in that case, they would still issue a boil water notice to take extra precautions to protect public health. It just doesn't mean that they're required to do that anymore under federal law.
So why do we understand why they're backing off from that, given that they could still do it, not requiring them to do it?
Well, I think that the federal changes are coming down because they're trying to create more consistency among states in how they address and putting resources towards the most immediate threat, where we know that E. coli has been known to make people sick. And really, the total coliform bacteria is an indication that something may happen, but it's not to that point yet.
Talking about E. coli, changing federal drinking water rules, the state DNR with Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior. Now, let's get into what's causing these problems in the first place. And again, I want to listen to some of the audio you got from Steve Elmore with the DNR.
Over the years, we have had a policy of trying to get to the root cause, but we don't always make even a site visit currently on these to find out what the problem is. Standard protocol is follow-up monitoring and a chlorination of the water supply.
So under existing rules, states aren't required, agencies aren't required to try to figure out what's causing these test results of this elevated coliform bacteria level. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. Right now, they have a less formal identification of the problem. That, you know, he said that they don't always make a site visit, but when they do see a problem, like, in, for instance, the Washburn treatment plant up near Lake Superior has had an issue in the past 5 years where there was an unknown something making it into the wastewater treatment plant there, and it caused a lot of problems. And so they did do an assessment to determine what was happening there and to fix the problem rather than just chlorinating or flushing, which they still did. But what this is going to do is it's going to formalize an assessment process. So whenever they see a positive finding of this kind of bacteria, that they're going to go out, they'll do a site visit, and that way they'll be addressing the problem sooner rather than waiting till maybe next year when it comes up as, you know, positive for E. coli.
So under these new federal rules now, the state or whatever agency responsible has to dig deeper and figure out, okay, why are we getting this test result, hopefully before it develops into a full-fledged E. coli problem?
Yeah, so under this rule, it's called the Revised Total Coliform Rule. It's a federal rule. And so the state is revising its rules then on how they address safe drinking water. And so what they're going to do is they're going to go out and do an assessment in every case for a community water system, which is usually like a city water system or a municipal plant. So they're saying that they're going to go beyond the requirements of the federal rule right now. And they're going to check whenever they get a positive finding of this type of bacteria, which they're not required to do right now. They could just have the owner or operator of the system do a self-assessment. But, you know, in this case with Marengo, the operator has had some deficiencies for more than a year with the wells on the site. And now with the new issues with the septic tanks, they're taking the necessary precautions to go and investigate what's happening.
So these new federal rules, when will they come into effect?
The new rules will go into effect next April. There is a public comment period that's coming up pretty soon here, and there's going to be a hearing notice posted on the DNR's website. And a public hearing is actually going to be held on July 22nd if people want to provide comment on what's going to be changing.
Now, bringing it back to where we started, Danny, in Marengo, the people with this suspect water, but not E. coli contaminated water, what's next for them? What do they do with their water?
Well, right now they've been asked to boil their water until these problems are resolved. And, you know, these have been problems that have been in place for more than a year now. There's three wells on site, only one working well, and now the septic tank issues. And so the department and the Department of Safety and I forget the exact name of it, but they're going to go through a consent order and take steps with the owner to resolve the issue and working with them in good faith to make it so that people can have safe drinking water there again.
Danny, thanks for covering this and for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Danielle Kading, WPR reporter based in Superior, talking about new federal rules on drinking water and how they'll affect us here in Wisconsin. Oil production is booming here in the United States, in part because of innovations in fracking technology. While concerns about the environmental impact are common, there are hopes that the boost in domestic production can make gas prices lower, more stable, decrease our reliance on foreign sources for oil, and help dial back U.S. military efforts in the Middle East as a result. But our next guest, an energy and international relations expert, says don't get too excited just yet because domestic oil production isn't going to bring us to energy security, especially in the long run. With us now is Steve Yativ. He's professor of international relations at Old Dominion University. He's the author of the new book, Myths of the Oil Boom, American National Security in a Global Energy Market. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So in your book, Steve, you set out to bust what you call some myths about the American oil boom. One, that the oil boom will substantially lower oil prices and our gas prices at the pump. It seems like supply and demand. Why wouldn't that be the case?
Well, I do think that it is the case in the short run and will be the case for the foreseeable future. The book looks a little farther down the road a few years from now. And the case, I think, will be different then. For example, the American oil boom is not supposed to run forever. It's produced a lot of oil and done some good things. But even the U.S. Department of Energy sees the American oil boom as peaking around 2019. Now, a lot of things will affect that, but even if it peaks later, it's not going to be a factor in the coming decades. So first thing is that it is going to peak in a few years. The second thing is that so far, the Arab countries like Saudi Arabia have not cut production to offset the American oil boom. But they're under enormous pressure at home to service their cradle-to-grave societies. They give subsidies for everything to their people, and they're running budget deficits. So they can only tolerate lower oil prices for so long, maybe a couple more years, but eventually I think they will also shift their policy. So the American oil boom is producing a lot of energy, which is positive, but I see down the road countervailing measures.
Another topic you tackle is the notion that with more domestic oil production, this is something you hear from politicians a lot of the time, if we produce more oil domestically, we're going to care less about the global oil market, be less vulnerable to price changes on that market. You, in the medium to long term, at least don't buy that.
Yeah, all things equal, the more oil on the global market, the better for oil prices. In that sense, the American oil boom is pressuring oil prices. But some people think, for instance, that this will allow us to leave the Persian Gulf. And there's a lot of discussion about that. Even the Arab countries in the region are worried that the U.S. will leave. The thing is, though, that the global price of oil is set on global markets. And if the U.S. left the Persian Gulf and there was some huge conflict there because the police officer is gone and oil prices rocketed, that would come back to hit the American consumer because the consumer is paying the global price of oil on markets. It doesn't matter how much exactly is produced where.
Yeah, as I understand it, and I think you mentioned this in your book, the United States doesn't really get that much of its oil directly from the Middle East. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It gets about 13%, which is a whole lot less than Europe or Japan or China.
But because those other countries get it, because it's a global market, you say even though we don't get our oil there, we're going to have a continued interest in stability there.
Exactly, because oil traders set the price of oil, and that happens mostly on the New York Mercantile Exchange. And if there's events in the Middle East that they think is going to disrupt oil prices, they're going to buy oil futures, send the price up, and that's what drives gas prices up. So if the U.S. is not in the Gulf and there's a problem there, prices go up, we're still paying more even if we're producing a ton at home.
And you say in the book, even absent oil, the United States and other countries would still probably have a strategic interest in the Middle East, in the Persian Gulf. Why is that?
Yes, I think absent oil, the U.S. could decrease its commitment there, and that would be a good thing because it's been extremely costly. But at the same time, even without oil, there are other interests there. For example, the Islamic State, although I don't support any ground troops against it, is still an issue because of transnational terrorism potential there. So there's terrorism and there's other issues that would keep the U.S. engaged anyway.
And another myth, and this is one of your chapter titles, gasoline costs us what we pay at the pump. Why not?
Yeah, this is one of the biggest things. It's called externalities by economists. And the idea is that providing for oil, which we get gas from, has a lot of costs associated with it. For example, I looked at 11 extremely detailed studies about what it costs the U.S. to protect the Persian Gulf alone, and that's around $40 to $50 billion per year. And a lot of that is because there's oil there, although the U.S. is there for other reasons. In addition, oil and coal are the primary causes of climate change. And those costs are incalculable at this point, but we from scientific studies know that they're high. So there are lots of costs associated with the gasoline that we use that aren't factored into the price at the pump.
We're talking to Steve Yativ. His new book is Myths of the Oil Boom, American National Security in a Global Energy Market. Well, that's the oil boom side of things, the production side of things. The second part of your book and the second part of your argument focuses on the consumption side of oil. You're making the case in your book that whatever we do with this domestic oil production, we should be looking for alternatives to radically bring down our oil consumption. What would you like to see?
Yes, the argument of the book in terms of policy is that, yeah, let's continue with the oil boom, but let's not think that that's all we need to do. Let's combine it with efforts to decrease oil consumption. And here I just want to emphasize a revenue-neutral gas tax. This is not a tax at all, but it's a tax on gasoline and carbon that we then offset with decreases in taxes on other things like payroll. It's been an idea that's been bandied around for a while, and it's got some Republican support because it's not really a tax, but it targets gasoline and carbon and therefore shifts consumer taste away from things that use gasoline and carbon. Another thing is, you know, putting more effort into high-performance vehicles, because most of the world's oil is used in transportation. So if we can target the gas tank either through taxation or through efficiencies, that would do the most to decrease, you know, the use of oil.
Isn't this a hard sell? Because with this oil boom in the U.S., gas prices have gone down from their peak a few years back. Oil is abundantly available to us. So why are we going to be worrying at this moment about better gas mileage and alternatives to oil?
That's a good question. That is the threat, that we can become complacent because we're producing oil. And producing oil and natural gas is fine, but we can't be complacent about it. Quite the contrary, because gas prices are lower, I think that it's a good time to consider raising the federal gasoline tax of 18.4 cents. And engaging in these kinds of actions. Now, it could be sold to the consumer, because studies show that although consumers are against gasoline taxes by about 3-1, they have a different view of a revenue-neutral tax, which is not a tax really. So if some politicians could be a bit more bold in pushing a revenue-neutral gas tax, they might find that the public supports it. The alternative is to raise taxes on other things to fund our infrastructure. It has to be paid for in some way, and that's coming to roost soon, that they're going to have to raise funds for the highway fund. So you might as well raise them with a revenue-neutral gas tax that may have one revenue-raising dimension to it. And I think because gasoline prices are lower now, it's gonna affect the consumers, in terms of political taste, a little less strongly.
At one point in the book, you used the phrase moonshot alternative energy effort, something an equivalent to the Apollo program, I guess, to try to come up with oil fossil fuel alternatives. Do you think the appetite is there to make that kind of upfront investment in alternatives to oil?
I'm not sure if the appetite's there yet, but I hope that it develops, and that will require good leadership, because the climate change issue is a serious one, and it's one that we need to address in a way that actually helps American business instead of hurts it. The United States has the best technology in the world and has the best companies in the world. And it has the potential to draw on all that great knowledge and innovation to be a leader in the world in clean energy. And so far, China is beating us to that clean energy market.
And turning back to national security, a lot of focus has been on the power of oil producers over the years. You say this could give us this kind of moonshot approach, developing alternative energy, breaking dependence on oil, could boost our national security, give us a lot of soft power on the world stage. How does that work?
Right, because soft power is the power of attraction, making your policies more attractive to others. And if the United States can lead on decreasing the use of carbon that'll send a positive message around the world that it's on the right road, because now the United States has a reputation as the big gas guzzler of the world. And in part, it is a big gas guzzler because the U.S. economy is the biggest, but it also has that reputation like oil for war and so on and so forth. So if it changes its tune, its policies will be received better around the world, at least according to what the polls show.
Steve, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
That was Steve Yativ. He's a professor of international relations at Old Dominion University. We've been talking about some of the arguments he makes in his new book. It's called Myths of the Oil Boom, American National Security in a Global Energy Market. According to census data, only about 2% of Americans consider themselves to be multiracial. But a new report out today from Pew suggests that the real number of people with multiracial backgrounds is more than three times that. It also shows that the number of people who identify as multiracial is growing three times faster than the population as a whole. The numbers speak to the idea that racial identity can often be subjective, a lot of different factors going into how a person actually identifies. For example, the largest multiracial group appears to be people with European and Native American roots, but they're the people least likely to describe themselves as multiracial. Here to talk with us about the increase in multiracial backgrounds in the United States and how we identify is Aaliyah Saperstein, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Stanford. Aaliyah, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So this report says multiracial adults, about almost 7% of the population. U.S. Census data says about 2%. Why this dramatic difference?
Well, it's a good lesson that sociologists, demographers, and survey researchers have known for a long time, which is it matters how you measure. It matters the kinds of questions that you ask people. You can think of an analogy of asking people if they want a policy of affirmative action or asking people if they support racial preferences. Depending on how you phrase the question, you're going to get different answers, and the same is true here.
Well, and with talking about race, we could mean genetic ancestry. We could mean how we identify ourselves. We could mean how other people identify us, and each of those could lead to three or more different answers for the same person. So does that make it particularly difficult to try to study the concept of race and multiracial identities?
Absolutely. But I think, at least for me, it's a really exciting time that now more and more people are realizing that those different questions actually give us different answers rather than thinking that there is just one true answer about race for everyone.
Are we having less of a fixed concept of what race is? I mean, this multiracial category in the census is pretty new.
Actually, the census doesn't use a multiracial category. They allow people to mark more than one of the existing categories, but just being able to do that is definitely new. And I think it, you know, in some ways we're seeing people adapt to that over time, but it is interesting, I think, in the report that they find that, you know, there are people who will say, I'm white and black, or I'm white and Asian, but maybe only about a third of those people will say, I'm multiracial, you know, sort of identify with that more umbrella category.
So when we talk about race in a report like this new one from Pew, what do we mean? What does the word race mean in this context?
I think it depends on which question you're talking about, right? So one of the things that Pew asked people was whether or not they knew whether any of their earlier ancestors were a different race than you know. So if I identify as white, for example, do I know if I have any ancestors, even going back past my great-grandparents, that might have been classified or identified as a different race than me? And so that's going to give a very different answer than how do I think other people see me, or you know, how would I identify myself, how my parents identify, how, you know, my children might identify, that sort of thing.
Now, when this report says the number of multiracial people is increasing in the United States, it's one of the fastest growing sectors, do we mean there are more people who are now identifying themselves as multiracial, but the same genetic definition of race, or are there actually more people that we'd all agree are multiracial than there used to be?
That's an excellent question, and I think that's one of the ways that sometimes the topic of multiraciality gets a little bit confused. When people say that the multiracial population is growing faster than some other racial populations, they tend to be thinking about it in terms of the children who that the children who have parents who themselves would identify with different races. And you have to think about in the census, children are most likely going to be identified by their parents. So we don't really ask children what they think about themselves until they move out into their own household and get to fill out the form for themselves. So the population that's growing very quickly are the children in families where the parents are of different races. But as this report shows, we don't really know how those children are going to identify as they become adults. And the current adults who we might be able to describe as multiracial by their backgrounds don't necessarily identify that way when when asked that question directly.
We're talking about multiracial identity in the United States. A new report just out from the Pew Research Center says there's a lot more multiracial people in the United States than at least the U.S. Census Bureau claims. Complicated issue we're sorting out with Elias Saperstein from Stanford University, sociologist there. We'll bring in a Wisconsin perspective now. We've got Jennifer Sims, a visiting professor of sociology at UW-River Falls. Jennifer, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, in this report, it talks about on a national level how people's multiracial identity works out. What kind of differences, looking at this report, do you see in how Wisconsin thinks of these issues?
The main difference I saw with regards to national and Wisconsin is, as Leah mentioned, the Pew Center report asked for any known ancestors. And so it wasn't surprising then when I saw that mixed Native Americans were the largest group. And so scholars really kind of separate out between two different types of mixed-race Native Americans, those who have more of a symbolic understanding. There's, quote, family rumors of a Native American ancestor, and then those who have more of a lived experience, those who participate in cultural events, visit or live on the reservation, registered with the tribe, face discrimination for being Native. And one thing that I found when interviewing people around the country was that here in Wisconsin, there are more people with that lived experience that do have the tribal registry, that are connected with the tribe, versus just kind of saying, yes, I know there are Native Americans somewhere in my background. But here in Wisconsin, people really still have that tangible connection.
Right. That was one of the findings of the report. This is the biggest category, biggest multiracial category, but few people identify as multiracial. They're different in Wisconsin, you're saying.
Right. I'm saying those that I interviewed within Wisconsin were able to describe cultural events they went to, visits to the reservation or family members on the reservation, versus mixed-race Americans who mentioned, yes, I know there's Cherokee or I know there's Apache in my background, and other regions of the country, California, in southern states, kind of knew of a rumor of an ancestor but didn't have that actual connection that I found with people here in Wisconsin.
And you mentioned facing discrimination. That's not just for people with mixed Native American and European American identities. How about people with African American or Asian American backgrounds who are multiracial? Do they face the same discrimination that we associate African Americans facing, or how does that fit in?
Right. Well, each different category, I suppose, of mixed-race person faces a different type of discrimination based on different things. With regards to Wisconsinites, the main thing that I noticed with regards to the report and Wisconsin in particular was that here in Wisconsin, mixed-race people are seen as non-white, not just in a negative way, but also in a positive way or a neutral way, but they are seen as non-white. The report noted that white Asian Americans, in particular, are kind of experiencing the world as white, but the white Asian Wisconsinites I interviewed did not experience the world as white. They talked very much about how here in Wisconsin versus other places like California, they are seen as non-white, and people react to them first and foremost as non-white, which was in direct contrast kind of to what, on a national level, white Asians experience.
And last time we talked to you here on the show, Jennifer, we talked about the what are you question.
Yes.
In Wisconsin, people multiracial not seen as fitting into a fixed category, and this is one of the most common questions, I guess, people hear.
Mm-hmm, they do. It's interesting, my new research, my dissertation was on the what are you question, but my new research here is asking non-mixed Wisconsinites, just asking general Wisconsinites, what race do you think this woman is, you know, based on pictures. And the mixed-race women, surprisingly, Wisconsinites are not marking or saying, I think this woman is mixed or biracial or multiracial. They are sorting them either into white, black, or Latino, which is an ethnicity, so that's very interesting, or they're not answering the question at all. But kind of the word mixed race, the multiracial identity term, is just not readily coming to mind for Wisconsinites.
And Aaliyah Saperstein, let's bring you back in on this conversation. The what are you question, big here in Wisconsin. Is that true across the nation? We just, people in a daily basis don't know how to categorize multiracial people and maybe awkwardly try to figure it out?
I think that's absolutely true. I think Jennifer's right. And I think we see that in the report that, across all the three major multiracial groups that they highlight in the report, white, black, white, Asian, and white American Indian, white Asians were the highest at saying that other people saw them as multiracial. At 20% of white Asians thought that other people saw them as multiracial. But that's not, that's actually a small minority then of all white Asians who think that when other people look at them, they actually recognize, they're not just trying to fit them into one box. But I do think across most of the country and for most people with a multiracial experience that they constantly feel like people are trying to fit them in a box. And that's what the what are you question is about.
We are talking about multiracial identity here in the United States. Aaliyah Saperstein is with us from Stanford University, sociologist there here in Wisconsin, visiting professor of sociology at UW River Falls, Jennifer Sims, and maybe with you. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself to be multiracial, or do you know you have ancestry of multiple races, different races, but you've picked one or the other to identify as, or maybe you don't think about the category at all? What aspects of your life experience go into how you identify racially? Here in Wisconsin, we have a significant Native American population. Report we're talking about from Pew says people with white and Native American backgrounds least likely to consider themselves multiracial. Why do you think that would be? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation now about multiracial identity here in the United States. New Pew study out suggesting the number of Americans with multiracial backgrounds, about 7% in the United States. That's three times more than census data previously suggested. Kind of a complicated issue here. To help us sort it out, we have Aaliyah Saperstein, sociologist at Stanford University, Jennifer Sims, visiting professor of sociology at UW River Falls. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you consider yourself multiracial? How does that affect your lives? How do you see yourself? How do other people treat you? Do they pick a category and put you in it, or what? Call in at 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll go to our callers now. We've got Elizabeth on the line in Wisconsin Dells. Elizabeth, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm actually half Hispanic. My father has roots from Spain, and my mom is from Wisconsin. She's Scandinavian, the whole melting pot. But I've always wondered why Hispanic or Latino, Latina ethnicity and not a race. It's
quick. Gotcha, Elizabeth. You're breaking up there, but why Hispanic and ethnicity on places like the census, I believe, not a race? So, Aaliyah, making our complicated conversation even a little more complicated, how do we fit that into the Hispanic category into our discussion of multiracial identity?
Elizabeth's question is an important one, and it's one that the census is grappling with as they prepare for 2020. And one of the things they are looking at is trying to ask the question in a way that allows people to see their Hispanic background as very similar to the way that white people or black people or Asian people would think of it, that it is part of their racial background and not just their ethnicity or some combination of their race and their ethnicity. And it's interesting, the Pew report actually asked people, once they identified as Hispanic, they asked them, do you think of this as your race? Do you think of this as your ethnicity? Both? Are you not sure? And about two-thirds of people, of Hispanic people in the survey, said they either think of it as their race or they think of it as both their race and their ethnicity. So I think that's something that, the census and other surveys are going to have to grapple with, that, it's important to reflect how other people how people want to identify themselves and, you know, what being Hispanic means to them.
And Jennifer, I don't know if you got into a Hispanic identity in your research on multiracial identity in Wisconsin. If so, what did you hear about that?
Right. So not in my previous interviews, it was not addressed very much. But in my current work on racial perception, Wisconsinites are marking the pictures of women that they view, some of them as Latino or as Hispanic, even though all verbal and written instructions say, please mark the race you think this woman is. It's interesting that they are pulling that term when asked about race. And so we sociologists see Hispanic as an ethnicity presently, but it's being racialized, which means the category is becoming more defined as we understand races than as we understand ethnicities. And as Aaliyah said, for two-thirds of Latinos, they already see themselves as racialized as Latino.
And I think I've seen on forums categories like boxes to check, like non-black Hispanic, so that Hispanic could be somebody who outsiders would identify as black or African-American or white or European-American or Hispanic as a race of itself. Aaliyah, how do we sort that out?
Well, I think one of the things that the census is testing and that the Pew Report used, actually, in the way that they asked people about race was to give Hispanic or Latino as a category alongside white, black, Asian, Native American, et cetera. And that way you could mark Hispanic and black if you wanted to you know, indicate that you are Afro-Latino, for example. Or you could mark white and Hispanic if you wanted to indicate, perhaps like Elizabeth, that she has background, you know, that her Hispanic background is actually from Spain. Or you could just mark Hispanic if you did, in fact, want to say that, you know, this is how I identify. I identify as Latin American. I identify with Latin American people, not with whites or blacks.
Go back to our callers now. We've got Cynthia on the line in Milwaukee. Cynthia, hi.
Hi. How are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Cynthia?
Yes. I just wanted to mention how sometimes even for college applications or even to filling out a job application is, it's really hard to come to terms sometimes with yourself, and sometimes I find myself asking, what am I? You know I have Asian background, but mostly I identify myself as a Latino, when other people that are in my same family, they identify themselves just as Mexican and nothing else. So, you know, it's just one of those situations where, you know, you want to identify yourself as something, yet sometimes that option is not available for you to pick.
Well, and that's on the college application, the job application, Cynthia. And we mentioned that question earlier that a lot of multiracial people get, evidently. What are you? Do you encounter that question in your daily life?
Oh, definitely. Most likely. Because when people look at me, they always ask me, where are you from? You know, I never, I don't think I ever felt like I could be from here, even if I was. So many times they're like, you must be Indian or you must be, you know, Filipino. So
they're picking for you.
Exactly. So many times it's like, oh, don't, you know, answer that question yourself. And sometimes I play this game where I ask them and I tell them, well, take a guess. And that's where a lot of, you know, these other ethnicities and other nationalities come from. So one time in particular, this guy asked me what country was I from, and jokingly I told him, oh, I'm from Colombia, but I'm from Mexico. And he's like, oh, yeah, I've been to that part of Mexico before.
All right, Cynthia, thanks a lot for that call. She has fun with it. Not everyone does, Jennifer. In interviewing people, do people get fed up with the what are you question?
Oh, yes, definitely, especially when the question comes from strangers, people who are not interested in getting to know you as a person. They just can't place you based on sight. One Wisconsin woman who's black, white, Native American discussed how people will just stop her on the street or when she's picking up her children and won't even know her and say, excuse me, I just want to know, what are you? And they're not interested in getting to know her as a person or as a friend. They just saw her and were confused and felt that it was fine to interrupt her daily life to satisfy their curiosity. And she, when she was younger, she said she used to enjoy it. It made her special, got her, you know, attention. And after 30 years of this, she's definitely now fed up with it.
Cynthia, thanks for that call. We're talking about multiracial identity, a new study out from the Pew Research Center on how many people are multiracial, how many people consider themselves to be. Aaliyah Saperstein is with us from Stanford University. Jennifer Sims from UW River Falls. Another part of Cynthia's question, Aaliyah, she doesn't know what to do on forms. And that's a big question. We're talking about the census, job application, university application. We're taking what we're discovering here this half hour is a really complicated, a fluid question, and trying to build categories on it that we can measure stuff with.
Yeah, I think the hardest part is, I think we have these categories, but in many situations, we don't know why people are asking. And so what I heard in some of what Cynthia was saying was, I don't know what I should put because I don't know what you're going to do with that information. And I think that's a step that we still need to take, is kind of, you know, why is it that we're asking people? Is it just so that they can identify, in which case Cynthia should be able to say whatever she wants, right? She should be able to check as many boxes as she wants. She should be able to write in whatever she wants. But sometimes it may be helpful to know, well, and I think the report highlights that a small proportion of people did identify in particular ways on their college applications, presumably because they thought that identifying in a particular way was going to be more advantageous than identifying in another way. And I think that conversation is a much thornier one. Is it that we're trying to reward particular answers? Is it that we're going to allot money differently if people give particular answers? I think a lot of people are wary about what that data is going to be used for.
Well, if I could ask maybe kind of a wonky question to both of you, there's this new study, there's the census, all these different efforts to try to measure what multiracial identity is, how many people are part of it, what it means. What don't we know, Aaliyah, that you wish we could know? What measures would you like to see that would help you in your research, maybe help us as a society?
I think it really, I'll be curious to hear what Jennifer thinks too, but I think it really depends on what you're most interested in. I think if we're concerned about discrimination and the way that people are treated by others, then we need to know how other people see them. I think that was something that came out really, it was really interesting in the report that, you know, depending on whether people saw the multiracial people in the study could say, oh, other people see me as white, other people see me as black, other people see me as Asian or Hispanic or multiracial. And I thought it was really striking that even the people who said they were seen as multiracial still felt like they experienced discrimination in restaurants. Were unfairly stopped by police, for example, which of course made me think of Tony Robinson in Wisconsin. I think we need to think about the information. You know, the question may be different depending on the information that we're looking for.
And Jennifer, you do interviews, you use numerical type data. What do you want to know? What do you wish we as a society knew?
Well, the main thing that I always wonder about studies, and that actually the Pew Research answered this time, is change over time. We often act like racial identity is this set thing from birth to death, and it's, for a lot of people, not just mixed-race people, but for a lot of people, it's not. Your identity changes. The strength of your attachment to that identity changes, and so I always wonder when there's a report that says this many people are this particular race. Well, you know, how has that changed over the lifetime? So I was very happy to see that the Pew Center did address that. And I also love to see data on why people identify a certain way. They had quotes in this Pew Center report saying, well, people see me this way, this is why I identify, or I don't know this side of the family, or I do have this cultural experience, and this is why I'm picking that. And so I think that data is very rich and very valuable as well, because both of those are going to show us that race is not this biological thing, but this social construction. And so those questions change over time. Why people identify, really get at the socially constructed nature of race.
Thanks to both of you, Jennifer Sims and Aaliyah Saperstein, sociologists, talking about multiracial identity in the U.S. You can keep sharing your experiences on the Central Time Facebook page.